Have you ever been to a family event and you've been sitting down on the ground with your child who's crying under the table, and a relative wonders out loud why you're not just being tougher? Maybe you're trying to explain ADHD to a teacher, or maybe your partner just thinks it's all screen time and doesn't even believe in ADHD. Enter A Child's Diagnosis, A Mum's Guide to Support and Helping Others Get It. Now, this guide is here to save you from those endless justifications and give you a break from being the ADHD explainer in every room that you enter. Here's what's inside. How to talk to professionals, because forgetting all of your points and remembering them in the shower later isn't really the vibe that you need in an appointment. How to handle skeptical relatives, being armed with responses that are factual, firm, and just the right amount of smile and nod. Support for your child, because navigating a world built for neurotypicals and Uncle Bob's back in the day speech really just doesn't help. And also practical strategies for school and home that work in real life. This guide isn't just about managing a diagnosis, it's about making sure your child feels seen, supported, and unconditionally loved, whilst you stay calm, or at least look like you're calm. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au. It's far less awkward than telling your mother-in-law to stop calling ADHD a phase. All right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have one of the most anticipated episodes, which is around AFRID, which is Avoidant Food Restrictive Intake Disorder. And we are moving towards a clinical insight around what practical things we can do at home. If you've been listening consistently, you will know that last week we interviewed Claire Britton around her personal struggle with AFRID and how that's impacted her, and from her as an adult, what she wishes parents knew. However, today we are interviewing Margot, who Claire recommended. If you'd like to know more about Margot, I'm going to put all of her information in the show notes. Margot is a certified practicing nutritionist, and she owns Whole Body Nutrition. Margot is a very proud AUDHDer, which is an ADHD, so she's both autistic and ADHD. She's a mother of two. Margot understands the challenges that both her clients and families are navigating when they come to the clinic. Her passion comes from a lived experience with an eating disorder in her youth and the very limited information that was available to her and her family when it came to understanding about feeding differences back then. So Margot has a pretty unique style of practice. She's very neuroaffirming, she's trauma-informed, and she has lived experience. So she really gently encourages clients to understand and accept that there are different ways of eating, and really validating sensory feeding differences, which really builds on having a strong relationship between child and parent or child and therapist. So welcome to you, Margot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so if you are wanting to understand the basics of AFRID, please go back and listen to Claire's episode. We are not going to re-go back into it, because when we have practical strategies people here, I try to bypass that and go straight to what we all want to know. First things first, Margot, what would be some of the early warnings around AFRID that parents should really start looking out for?
There's quite a few, and so I'll go through the main ones. In younger children, you might see sometimes weight loss or delayed growth or even difficulty gaining weight. There might be some nutritional deficiency symptoms that pop up, and this might include fatigue, pale skin, getting sick regularly, sometimes hair loss or dry skin, brittle nails. But also, you might see a reduced appetite or a lack of interest in terms of food and eating. And some kids will eat very slowly. They'll often have a very limited diet, and this may be due to sensory differences, not liking certain tastes, textures, the smells, or the visual look of food. You might find that some kids with AFRID may eat the same foods daily, and they might eat those foods for a day, a week, a month, a year, nonstop. And then they might experience what we call a food jag, where that food gives them the ick and they can't go back to that food, either ongoing or for a short amount of time. Also, kids with AFRID will choose not to eat if there are no safe foods available. And this is really a can't, not a won't. Food is a threat to the nervous system. There might be a lot of anxiety and or distress around food and meal times. There might be lots of meltdowns. There might be resistance, anxiety, or fear around foods, and particularly fear around trying new foods. And then one other thing that you might see is social anxiety or withdrawal, particularly at events or school when food is involved. Kids may prefer to eat alone, and it might be challenging for them to eat with others. And I'd say the last thing really is we might see digestive concerns. So we might see constipation or pain or cramping or even reflux in some kids.
Is it then true that Afrin is going to be more around neurodivergent children, or is this typically with neurotypical as well?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because obviously I don't want to minimise anyone's experience. However, in my clinical experience, I've only actually ever had one client that's come to me with ARFED and said that they were neurotypical. And as we went on talking through their case and through their history, you know, I could definitely see signs of autism there. So typically, I always see ARFED co-occurs with autism or autism and ADHD in my clinic. And some health professionals actually believe that ARFED is another subset of autism, kind of similar to how PDA is. So I can kind of understand why, just due to my clinical experience and the fact that ARFED is pretty much always linked to sensory processing differences. So those difficulties with taste, texture, smell, and the visual aspects of food. So in terms of what we might see, though, in neurodivergent children with ARFED, as I've mentioned, the sensory processing differences, and they might also have big challenges with interoception and feeling hunger or fullness cues, which can impact appetite and eating regularly. And because of this, we'll often see like a reduced range of foods in the diet. We might also see that a child will need consistency routine with meals. And if there's change or unpredictable things happen which impact that routine, this can become very distressing for the child and actually impact their ability to eat. So often we might also see kids needing food to be prepared in a specific way. I'm sure many of us can relate to our children needing, you know, for example, like a peanut butter sandwich that has to be a specific bread brand, a specific peanut butter brand. The bread has to be cut a certain way, and then sometimes it also has to be served a certain way on a specific plate. And if anything is different, like slightly different, like too much peanut butter or not enough, they'll refuse to eat. This is a safety mechanism for them. Also, neurodivergent kids with ARFED will also eat the same foods on repeat. As I mentioned before, we might see that they'll eat them, you know, for days, weeks, months, or ongoing until they might experience a food jag. And that doesn't always happen, the food jags, that is. And most of the time for children that are neurodivergent with ARFED, if there are no safe foods available, they will starve themselves. They will choose not to eat versus eating something that doesn't feel safe. And I have also seen a lot with neurodivergent kids that are forced to eat something that they don't want to eat. What actually happens is their nervous system may switch into sympathetic dominance, so fight or flight, and then into fawn mode, which is where we do anything to prevent a conflict, and we do anything that we can do to please an adult or another person to avoid conflict. And then what happens is the child will mask up, eat that food, even if it causes gagging or distress for them. Finally, I'll just say as well, there's always a big anxiety picture there, and I find it really common that there's often a trauma picture there as well, which the trauma picture can come from many different things, ranging from, say, a baby that's born that has a lip and tongue tie that needs cutting, or difficulty breast or bottle feeding, or maybe they have digestive issues, all the way over to being force-fed as a child. All of these things and more can lead to trauma events, which can deeply impact a child with ARFED's development and also ability to eat food, basically.
Wow, that was
that was really. I really got my verbal vomited.
No, I loved it. It was really, really informative. Thank you, actually. So online, I see lots of information around ARFED, but I'm always really careful about what I look at and where it's come from, because, you know, online, you never know how true something is. What are some of the myths around ARFED that you see that you think just aren't true, that people think are true?
Okay, so there's many myths that are out there in regards to ARFED. And so you do have to be careful with what you hear. One of the main things that I see often is that there's this assumption that individuals with ARFED only eat beige foods. And this is actually not true for many people. It really does depend on the individual and their ethnicity, their cultural background, so many different things. So many of my clients actually do eat colorful foods, not all of them, but some do. So that's one. Another one is that a lot of people think that if you keep exposing RFID individuals to new foods, that they'll eventually eat them or that they'll grow out of RFID. This is really not true. And I've had so many parents come to me with their children after they have done something like feeding therapy, which has really traumatized their child and led to a huge reduction in foods and a massive increase in anxiety around food. So exposures are not always the way. And sometimes we actually do have to sit in safety with our child and work on supporting their body and building nourishment through safe foods and, if needed, through supplementation as well. So another massive one, and this is something that I'm really passionate about, is that a lot of people believe that you can quote unquote cure or fix RFID. The more that I learn about RFID and the more lived experience I hear, it really leads me to believe that RFID is not something that you can quote unquote cure or fix. The way that I look at RFID is that it's actually a neurodivergence. And so that basically means that RFID is a neurotype that differs from the societal standard or norm. And this cannot be quote unquote cured or fixed. It's their neurological wiring, especially if they have had it from a very young age. So you may then assume that someone with RFID will always have RFID. However, depending on individual circumstances, trauma that happens, their capacity, the dynamics around RFID might change and it might fluctuate. So sometimes there might be more capacity for eating and more variety, and sometimes there may be less, and we may need to rely on safe foods and nutritional supplement to meet their nutritional needs. But, you know, I really believe that every parent is doing the best that they can with the nervous system that they have at the time, with the information that they have at the time. We all make mistakes, but when we know better, then we can move forward and do better. We're human beings. This stuff is going to come up, but really focusing on, okay, where to from here? How can we support our child moving forward, basically?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's really tricky, isn't it? Because you want to give the parents more tools, but you don't want to shame them about what they have not been doing in the past because they didn't know better. I think it's a great point. One thing I wanted to talk about was secrecy. So we have RFID in my house, and it is by far the most difficult part of parenting, I think. By far, it's beyond anything else in terms of, if I could just call a spade a spade, frustration. And it's very, very, very difficult. Lunchboxes are a big problem in our house, and there seems to be a lot of secrecy with one of my child particularly. I was wondering if secrecy and RFID has any kind of correlation, or whether they're related or not.
Yes, definitely related. So common. So I'm going to talk through some of the reasons why there might be this secrecy. So first of all, if a child with RFID eats a specific set of foods, they may feel embarrassed or anxious about other people noticing or commenting, especially if their food preferences seem different to their peers. They might worry about someone saying something like, "Why do you always eat like that?" or "That looks weird," which could make them feel self-conscious and judged for their food choices. It might make them feel like their eating habits are quote unquote wrong or different, which can really bring up feelings of shame and embarrassment. And this is one of the reasons that can lead to secretive eating. It's all about keeping yourself safe and avoiding feeling those awful feelings. They may have also had past experiences where, you know, a well-meaning person, maybe it's a teacher, a friend, or a family member, has made a comment about what or how this person eats. And even neutral or positive comments can feel overwhelming and upsetting for RFID kids. Eating alone reduces that from happening, and eating alone as well can be more regulating for kids with RFID and adults too, because there's less sensory overwhelm and there's less pressure to eat or to finish eating in a certain time or to eat all the food that's put out. And another thing is that, you know, a lot of kids with RFID do struggle with that sensory overwhelm from other smells in the environment from other foods. You know, a lot of kids will have misophonia where they really struggle with hearing other people eating. And so eating alone means that they don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And there's no unexpected smells or sights or social interactions that might increase their nervous system distress and then stop them from eating. So most likely, if a child or an adult are needing to eat alone, it's really a protective mechanism that they're using to keep their nervous system regulated and safe so that they can eat and avoid any judgment or criticism from others.
Oh, that's completely what I have at home or at school. One thing that is, I so love the teachers at our school. I think they really go above and beyond in terms of actually making sure that kids are okay, like on an emotional level. So they do go around and check, because I think in the area that we live in, maybe there are some kids that come to school without any food. And I think that is actually what they're doing. But because they're checking, and I'm air quoting checking, I think they're checking to make sure that everyone has food because they do have spare food. But I think that checking of the lunch boxes comes across to a kid with ARFID, like they're checking because, and maybe that child's not eating what they're supposed to be eating, air quoting, like it's not a sandwich. And then it comes off anxiety producing. That makes sense with what you're saying, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And I think as well, there's a lot of pressure on parents these days to have the perfect lunchbox, whatever that means. And I used to worry a lot about making sure my kids ate during the day, but it's not the be all and end all. If they don't eat during the school day, and this is super common for kids with ARFED and also neurodivergent kids for many different reasons, you can fill them up outside of school as well. There's always that option. And in regards to teachers, like there is that concern there for our kids eating. And I think as well, part of it comes down to this ideal that we have around, like what you said, like kids should be eating a sandwich at lunchtime versus eating maybe chocolate or whatever. And I say should with quotation marks. But if we're thinking about someone with ARFED or an eating disorder in any way, we would still rather them eat chocolate or eat a bag of lollies versus eating literally nothing. You know?
Oh, I feel like you're inside my house. Yes.
Yeah. And I think some teachers that don't understand that can be really challenging for them.
If you haven't experienced it, it actually doesn't sound right. When you've experienced it, you're like, oh, this is what I'm dealing with. I am literally thinking, should I let them have the chocolate bar or nothing? That's my option.
Exactly. And it's always better to have something versus nothing.
Absolutely. So there are a lot of people in the audience listening that have got kids with ARFID, and I feel like there's a lot of shame and confusion around it, particularly for people that don't have NDIS funding. It can be really difficult to receive help too. So obviously I like to call a specialist 100%, and someone like yourself would be a great person to start with. We can go through, you know, your website at the end and show notes if people want to kind of hear more from you. But is there anything that we can do practically at home that is helpful?
Yes, there's so many things. So the first thing that I always say to parents is to take a step back and start questioning and reflecting on whether the things that you're doing in your home when it comes to food, meal times, eating, and what you think these should all, quote unquote, should look like are due to societal pressures or perhaps pressures that have been placed on you from your parents or from your upbringing or from conditioning growing up, or if these are things that you're doing because they're actually what is best for keeping peace in your family, for supporting your child and yourself. Just in general, you can apply this to food and, you know, nutrition and mealtimes. You can apply it to anything. So if the answer is because of societal pressures, then it's time to really take a step back and reject neuronormativity and make some changes that will help to keep the family safe, calm, and regulated. So what does that look like? For a lot of families, that looks like saying no to family dinners, which are often at the end of the day when everyone's dysregulated and distressed, there can be lots of meltdowns. And so it's really worth thinking about how can we bring in peace and safety for everyone? And that might look different for every family, but for some families, it is about allowing distractions. So some families will still sit at the table, but they'll have their iPads, or they might listen to an ebook, Other families might all sit on the couch. Some families will all sit in different rooms. It's really dependent on what works best for you and your family. And another thing that I'll just say quickly about mindful eating, which, you know, society puts so much pressure on us to do mindful eating. It's not helpful for a lot of neurodivergent kids and adults, because what mindfulness does is it brings up distress and anxiety. And if we're already in a situation where we're feeling distressed and anxious, it brings that up even further. And then that can lead to not being able to eat. So distractions can be an incredible tool that you can use around mealtimes. And a lot of my clients say that as soon as they allow distractions and also stimming, letting children move their bodies, get up from the table, move around, play with fidgets, whatever they need to do, we see more food being eaten, less meltdowns, more regulation and calm at the table.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I felt like there was a period there where dinners were improving or they were going okay. And me being me, I actually feel really stupid saying this. I read a piece of research on family dinners and that family dinners create a more cohesive environment and have better outcomes. I got from that, this is what I should be doing, and removed the technology and attempted to put in riddles to create a bit more of a cohesive family. Now, the intention was great. The reality was that by taking away the distractions, I increased the ARFID rampant. Like, it went from 2 or 3, we went up to an 8 real quick. And reducing the distractions actually then increased the focus on what they were eating. And then we've seen a massive downhill spiral. Now, maybe other people out there would think, oh, we'll just give them back the iPad or the TV. Then it was like too late. And then it was really difficult to get that back on track. And it was difficult for me to understand that, because I was like, I could see my error. I'm just trying to backtrack and go back to where we were. But it was almost too late. So I really liked the way that you talked about the distractions, because the best case parenting that I had in my mind actually really has backfired on me.
Yeah, and a lot of that advice, like that study, would not have been based on neurodivergent, families. There's so much like research and stuff out there that says all of this stuff. And of course, we're going to believe it if we read it.
And I thought that was a reachable distance. Like, I thought, I'll just do that 2 nights a week. I didn't feel like it was that much of a push, but it was, clearly. And I regret that heavily.
And many kids in situations like that, that I see what happens and what you've described, I think it sounds to me like your child went into a bit of a burnout, and there might've been other stuff going on as well.
Oh, there were. Yeah,
she corrected that, not just the dinner table. But when we see kids in burnout, of course, capacity reduces so much. But how are you to know, you know? And sometimes, like, we're always just doing the best we can as parents, and sometimes things do sound really good and we give them a go, and sometimes they work really well and sometimes they backfire, and that's all part of the learning process. So another thing I would really encourage you to learn about your child's individual sensory processes and sensory preferences, and then make accommodations to make eating more accessible. So this not only includes food, but also the environment in which they eat. So if they're noise sensitive, headphones are great. If there are certain textures they don't like, don't put them on their plate. Because although well-meaning parents think that this is a good way to expose children, what it can often do is create a lot of anxiety for that child and lead to either not eating at all or less eating, or them feeling anxious and nervous around food. And we want to support a positive relationship around food. Another thing is basically reducing all pressure around mealtimes and eatings. So give your child autonomy. Let them choose what they want to eat and how much they want to eat, where they want to eat. Look, maybe there'll be some boundaries that you have to have for certain reasons. That's your decision. But typically, giving the child autonomy is what creates safety. As I mentioned before, fed is best. Eating anything is always better than eating nothing. And really avoiding making any judgments or comments on food choices and eating behaviors. So if your child wants to eat with their hands, let them. Why does it matter? If they like, you know, different food combinations, which might seem really weird to you, don't call them weird, fussy, picky, Just try to avoid making any judgments or comments on food and eating, because this does increase anxiety and distress around food. And, you know, kids with ARFID and adults are already feeling so much pressure and judgment from the world, just in general, because they are different. And so we don't want to add to that. Another thing is, don't pressure kids to eat foods, even if they've liked them once before. Many kids will, as I've said before, eat foods for a day, week, month on end, and then they might food gag and that becomes unsafe. Even if they've liked a food in the past, it doesn't mean that then we can just, you know, force them to eat it in the future. You can still say to a child like, hey, you remember last year you loved Milo, for example, or peanut butter toast. Would you want to give that another go? And it's up to them. And if they say no, we don't pressure. The last thing I would say is, it's so important at home to validate their experience, whatever it is. If something doesn't taste good for them, or they're feeling stressed about something, even if it feels ridiculous to you, it's really important to validate their experience. You know, it might feel like they're being stubborn, but most kids with ARFID, they desperately wish that they could eat more, that they could be more quote unquote normal like other kids. And their food fears and food differences, they're very real for them. And so really, we need to give them heaps of compassion, patience, and accommodations as much as possible.
Yeah, I agree. And I suppose it's that lived experience. Well, not that I think I have ARFID or I had it as a kid, but when you watch a child, your child or someone else's, actually attempt to eat something that they feel is not right for them, you see their face and it's like, you just can't be putting it on in any way. Like, it's just, I just don't see it as behavioural when I've watched one of my children cry and gag. Like, he wants to do it so bad, but can't. Yes. There's a consistent pattern. It's not just I wake up one day like, oh, I don't want to eat broccoli. It's so consistent and distressing that it's hard to watch. So we have some children, we have some ARFID children that have some safe foods, right? And, you know, my hope and everyone's hope and probably their hope is that they can expand their diet so they can eat more foods and it's not this big emotional anxiety thing around dinner or lunch, whatever it is. What can we do to expand the diets? What would be some gentle or neuroaffirming ways?
Yeah, so look, this is a really tough one and it definitely depends on the circumstance and whether the child's in burnout and things like that. But basically, trying new foods or food exposures, it has to be initiated by the child, not the parent. So the best strategies are to allow the child to have a full autonomy when it comes to trying new foods. If your child is in a space where they are in full-on burnout or there's a lot of distress, it's really important we just keep with safe foods. And if there's nutritional deficiencies, we can meet those through different supplements. But if your child comes to you and they say, I watched this person on YouTube make these noodles, I really want to get them from the shops. And the parents will go and get them. And I'd say probably 50% of the time, the child will make them with the parents and then the child won't eat them. And 50%, they'll give them a try. Both are actually wins because that child has made the decision that they want to be exposed to something. And exposures can look like more than just actually eating or trying something. I think a good way to start is, if they're okay with it, if they're in a safe space where they're able to do this, is inviting them to go shopping with you or to even browse online. Is there anything that looks interesting to you or that you'd want to try? And look, you might find that you buy five things or one thing and the child doesn't eat it, but that's okay. It's still a step in the direction that is a positive direction. But yeah, my main tip is that it has to be child-led. Otherwise, this increases distress, overwhelm, anxiety, trauma, and there needs to be very much no pressure from parents. And even, this one's a bit controversial, but when our children eat new things or eat anything, it's really tempting to praise the child and to clap or be like, yeah, well done, buddy. I'm so proud of you. What that does is that increases pressure on the child and it can make them feel like next time they have to do the same thing. So we want to avoid really commenting. Look, obviously every child's different, but typically we want to avoid commenting or anything like that. And that doesn't mean that you can't still feel your feelings. I say to a lot of parents, like, if your child does something and you're super pumped and excited, go into the other room and have a little dance, or go and high five, you know, your partner, or call a friend on the phone. Find other ways to celebrate that doesn't put pressure on the child. I hope that helps.
Oh, no, I agree with you around that. It seems to work with some kids and not with others. And I suppose that's what we're dealing with individuals. Some kids, depending on the relationship, are okay with that praise and makes them feel good and there's no pressure. But I suppose it depends on the relationship, the child. You know, yeah, there's probably no real rule with it, I would imagine. Yeah.
Exactly. It's, yeah, there's no rule. It's
hard to say whether it would or wouldn't be helpful if you didn't know the child and the relationship.
I always say to parents, you know your child best. You know them better than I do. These are the options. These are some ideas. You go away and do what works best for your individual
child. Totally. And I mean, even in our family, you know, I am able to do some things with the kids and my husband, they don't want him to know. But they'll come and high-five me because they've eaten something or they've done something, but they don't want him to know. So it's like even dependent on which parent, what day, you know.
If the child is super proud and they're wanting to high-five you or celebrate it, definitely, you know, like do that with them.
But I suppose you're just looking at ways not to then go, well, that's what you have to do now. That's now the new bare minimum. You did that one time, so you can do that again. Yeah.
Exactly.
So what do you wish that more parents knew about navigating after at home with less stress and guilt?
We've sort of touched on this a little bit, but, you know, a lot of parents can blame themselves for their child's development of ARFED, but really it's not their fault at all. It's not a reflection of parenting. There are so many things that can contribute to ARFED development. Neurodivergence is one of them. And of course, with autism, the sensory processing differences. And so there are lots of different external factors that can lead to ARFED development. And I think that there's also a lot of pressures from outside families, friends, and even the medical professionals to, as we've mentioned sort of before, fix a child's, and I say quote unquote, fix a child's eating. But ARFED really doesn't work like that. It's about understanding, supporting, making accommodations, and not forcing or disciplining the child. That is not going to be helpful. And the other thing that I just want to say is we get so many messages as parents from society, again, family, friends, the media, like you name it. All you've got to do is look out on a billboard and you'll see diet culture and things like that everywhere. And the pressure is that we, quote unquote, should be eating a certain way to be healthy, that we should look a certain way, that we should eat certain foods to be healthy. But there are so many different things that contribute to health, and what we eat is just one of them. And actually, according to the social determinants of health, less than 30% of health outcomes are attributed to what we eat. And so, look, I'm not saying that nutrition isn't important, but if someone has ARFED and they have a limited diet, there are ways for us to support their nutritional needs that don't involve forcing a child to eat a variety of food. And the most important thing when working with a child that has ARFED or an adult is to support their relationship with food. That is actually number one, because we can't add in food exposures or add in increased food intake or variety if that relationship with food is broken. That's something that has to develop over time with a lot of support and education.
Yeah, it's interesting. Have you heard of the Rock and Water program? They do that in primary schools in Queensland. And it's been really interesting because it's kind of a neurodivergent social skills program, I think. But they just do it in primary schools and they teach about rock is like when you're not flexible and water is when you are flexible. They talk about different times to be a rock and different times to be water. And then, you know, the water can move around and be flexible and the rock obviously can't. If you've got two rocks, what happens? And it's a really beautiful way of teaching young children. Anyway, I've been using that with my husband because, and so I was talking to him around ARFED about like, if you have a child that's being a rock and you're a rock, then you've got two rocks. So we have to be water at dinner time every day because we don't have water. We have a rock permanently and it's a child and they're not moving. And what does two rocks create? So I suppose you've got to try what you think might be a good approach from your family and see what works. One last question before I let you go. One of the big things that we have in my family, I think this would be probably really relatable for other people, is that my partner loves traveling. He loves it. I find it quite terrifying, and you could call it anxiety, but I call it forecasting, where I'm like, I love where your head's at. That sounds like a lovely plan. I'd love to go away for the weekend. But last time we did that, we took safe foods with us, but because we put them in a mini fridge, they then, air quoted, tasted different. And all of the money that we spent on that then went to waste. And we tried to get other food, which were then deemed not right. And, you know, we had two children that starved themselves over a weekend period and ended up being really awful moods because they were starving. And it didn't go great, to say the least. But my partner still seems to live in the land of, oh, it will be different this time. Whereas I'm like forecasting, like, I don't see how that would work. And I think after it can be really limiting where I feel like I can't go out for lunch because I have to feed the kids, if I can even get them to eat a safe food before or after it, or have to take foods with us. It's exhausting. And then you've got to plan for what you may not even, I mean, they're not even guaranteed they're going to eat the safe food. So the whole thing just feels overwhelming, frustrating. And I'm like, I don't even know how we're going to be able to go out for the day or for the weekend or go somewhere with people because of the limited food options that we've got. I know that was a bit of a long, sad story, but I was just wondering if there's any tips or strategies around any of that, or is that just unavoidable?
I think that lots of families will relate to what you've said, and I've seen this a lot in clinic as well. I do have a few tips. So going away obviously means a lot of change for kids, loss of routine, different food, different environments, and this can cause a lot of anxiety and dysregulation. So leading up to the holiday, a few things that I would do is really talking about your child with the holiday, where you're going, maybe showing them pictures, maybe looking up local restaurants or cafes or places where they might be able to get safe foods, looking at menus at these places, doing social stories, so a short story describing what will likely happen, what it might look like, basically using strategies that will help with providing a sense of safety, familiarity, and predictability for that child. And also lowering all expectations and demands about eating when you're away. So if you're away and say your child literally only eats hot chips for 2 days, that is still better than nothing. Don't make a fuss about it. Don't get too worried about it. They'll be okay. They'll survive as long as they're still getting fluids and stuff as well.
Hot chips and some fluids over a weekend would be a win.
Like, be a win.
That sounds so bad. That sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah. So, yeah, doing whatever you can to support nervous system regulation as well. So it might be that maybe you bring like a comfort blanket from home, or you might bring their favorite plate or the cutlery that they use. There could be, depending on the child, different things that could help with that regulation and just sort of the reminder of home, I guess. And if you're really, really committed to going on a holiday, for some families it might work better to go locally or to go somewhere that maybe you've been before so that that familiarity is there as well.
I loved what you said about, you know, show them the menu and the social story and the pictures. And I agree with you. That works, right? Like, I'm with you 100%. But I think this also contributes to, and I know that you would get this as an autistic mother yourself, where you're like, I'm actually sick of doing that. I remember the other day, it was my husband's birthday. He loves to travel and go out to eat. Poor man. He's just not got the right family for those two things, right? I was so nervous because I thought, I think we could all eat pizza. But, you know, it's like, oh, it has to be daddy has to make it. It has to be this certain type, certain thing. Anyway, I had to look it up, do the social story, battle with them, got them all on board. And then when I went to order, afterwards, I thought, who am I as a person? Because I said to the woman, you cannot do herbs. I don't want to see a spice. I don't want to see pepper, salt. Like, I just felt like the most craziest woman with the intense ordering that I did. Because it was an Italian place, I was like, I bet you they're going to try and do something nice with a garnish. I was like, no, you can put this. You can put this. I have so much anxiety around, getting up, checking it before it was presented, because I knew we were going kayaking for an hour after. And I thought, if they don't eat anything, what are we going to do? Like, I just, the anxiety around the pre-planning, then it contributes to my husband saying, let's go to SeaWorld or let's go here for the weekend. And I'm just there thinking about all the ways it'll go wrong, how much load I have to think through all of this stuff. Then my feeling at the end of it is, no, I don't want to. It's too hard, which I feel like a real negative Nancy. And he's looking at me like, well, what do you mean? It's like, but you don't get what actually has to go into that. So I know that wasn't really a question. It was kind of like a vent, really.
No, I'd love to comment on that because as I was saying everything, exactly what you said popped into my mind. And it's so valid because you also have needs. You also have a certain level of capacity. And so sometimes it isn't worth it. Sometimes the load that it takes for you to prepare for something is too much. And it's okay to also say, we can't do this because I'm at my capacity and I'm going to, you know, lose my SHIT if I have to go through all of this. So it's not always just about how my kid's going to feel. Your needs and feelings 100% matter as well. And it should be also taken into account with all of this stuff.
Oh, no. And I think you definitely didn't give the impression that, you know, that was just an expected thing that a mother would do. But there's some good strategies if you really wanted to go. But, you know, it's been difficult because you kind of have to grieve through what you thought you might have been able to do. And then you're not actually able to do that.
Yeah, so many different feelings can come up. And one last thing I'll just say is, you know, maybe for some families there's capacity where you can go out as a family, but maybe the kids need to eat before you go out or after you go out, depending on the circumstance. Maybe it's okay for them to be present with the family, but not eat, and there's no expectation or pressure. Sometimes that works really well for families.
Yeah, I agree. And if anyone's listening and they want to know more about that, I actually did a episode about boundaries and people pleasing just before Christmas. I'll put that in the show notes and I wrote out some scripts around if you're at Christmas and, you know, you've got your chicken nuggets with you and your child's going to eat the chicken nuggets over the family meal that has been created by a family member at Christmas, what would you say? How would you go around that? So if you'd like to hear more about that, we can put that into that episode as well. Thank you so much for your time, Margot. It's been so informative. Is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up?
As my closing kind of argument, if you will, I really did want to say, and I've sort of touched on this just before, that being a parent to a child with ARFED, having ARFED yourself, maybe it is emotionally exhausting and can be really, really hard. So get support for yourself as well. That would be one of the key things that I would say, if that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, thank you so much for your time. We will see how this episode is received. I'm sure it will be really needed. If anyone has any upcoming questions and they're like, oh, why didn't you ask Margot about this and this? You can always let me know. If you'd like to know more about Margot, I'm going to put all of her information in the show notes. So thank you so much for your time, Margot. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.